Hi there. I'm Melinda the Enforcer. I'm here with Greg Kokel, who's looking at me like suspiciously. And this is the STRS podcast, the one where Greg and I are silly, but we try to answer some questions.
I'm
with
never
Greg and
silly.
You're looking at me in a silly way.
I am just looking
you're
at
looking,
you.
No, it's the look in your face where you're trying to, you have something up and you're going to try to.
No, you said, hi there. I'm Melinda the Enforcer. And I was going to say, hi there. I'm Greg the Enforced.
Yes, that's true.
There you go. So,
or partially enforced. I do my best.
Yeah. So you don't always succeed.
Well, obviously not. You're a handful. You're a few handfuls.
The difference between the president and the CEO.
I'm not the CEO.
Well, you're the executive director.
Oh,
right. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I've got two words in my title. You've only got one. Anyways, I have a revisit a topic from last week that we discussed.
Okay.
Because you made a libel against the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Oh.
And you said that all the plots have to do with lying and, like, glorifying lying. And I was thinking, even when you said it, I'm thinking, because I'm rewatching, I'm going, I don't recall this. So I just sort of glanced down.
By the way, just so you know, libel is a falsehood in writing. I didn't
okay,
write
fine.
It. This is a slander, an accusation.
Slanderous.
Of a slander.
You slandered. So I glanced down the first season. So, there's examples. First episode, Richie gets sick and Rob wants Laura to come to a party at his boss's. There's an episode about Laura dyeing her hair because she thinks Rob's not interested anymore. There's an article about Sally dating the lab technician. There's a story about how Rob and Laura met. In fact, in the whole...
You're not going to find there. Rob lies to his wife.
I
about
watched
XYZ.
These things just recently.
Okay,
and in fact, there's one episode called "To Tell or Not to Tell," and that's Mel asks Rob if he would mind if they invited Laura to dance to fill in for a week, but he says I'll leave it up to you if you don't want her to do it. And so Buddy and Sally are saying, don't tell her, because she'll want to do it, and mm-hmm. then she'll want to get back into work. But Rob, against his own interest, tells Laura and that about this opportunity, which she does take. Mm-hmm. So in that case, the one time a lie comes up, he actually told the truth mm. when it could cost him. So
you know what
that
wait,
is not.
Wait, listen, you know what that sound is?
I know.
That's the sound of people changing the channels right
no,
now.
No, it's not. You don't care, but they care. So.
Brooke is falling asleep.
No, she's not.
Look at her.
It is just fault. You know, okay. You made a judgment based on I don't know what and false judgment, so you just need to be corrected with the actual data.
Okay. So let it be noted.
Okay. So here we go. Send us your questions on Twitter about apologetics theology, not old TV shows, although that does come up. And I will ask Greg, he's on a timer, so let's get going. First question comes from Rolfums. The neurons that govern memory and consciousness are never replaced. Are you sitting there with your crossed arms like somehow you're...
No, I'm listening.
No,
I'm just listening.
Just like, The neurons that govern memory and consciousness are never replaced. Does this weaken the argument for an enduring non-physical soul?
Well, I'd have to ask the question, how does it weaken it if that statement were strictly true? I don't know that it's actually true. I've made this comment before that the body cells are replaced, but neurons are not. And then I've had some people correct me on that, but that's not really relevant to the broader point. Because if you're talking about strict identity, see, the issue here is, what is it that sustains our identity, our sense of ourselves? We are ourselves. We were the people that were born on our birthday. If it turns out we don't have the body that we had when we were born on our birthday,
I wouldn't fit in it anymore.
There you go. So that's an argument for the existence of the soul based on our sense of the enduring self, even though their body cells have changed and died and reproduced and whatever. It's not the same body, strictly speaking. And all that would have to be the case to make the case, the argument, is that our body would have had to change. It wouldn't have to be the case that every cell in our body would have to change. It would just that our body would have to change to make the case that we are not identical with our bodies. And unless somebody wanted to make the case, well, then we are identical with the neurons that never change. That's where our identity resides. And my response is, well, how does it make any sense at all that the I that I am and everything that's pertaining to that notion of self is somehow exactly the same thing as neurons in my body? Mm-hmm. Because neurons have biological qualities that I don't have. I am conscious, but my neurons aren't conscious. I make, I have thoughts and decisions and acts of will and all of these intentions, mm-hmm. all of these things that are soulish activities that just are not characteristic of neurons firing. So that in itself should be enough to see or to demonstrate that I am not identical with my neurons in this case. Now, just for the sake of understanding, so people have it clear, when I say identical, I'm using the word identical in a strict philosophical sense. I don't mean that, you know, when they say identical twins, we say, well, they look alike. Okay, but they're not identical. Here's identity. Greg Kochel is identical to the president of, and founder of Stand to Reason. Okay, that is, everything that's true about me is true about the one who is the president of Stand to Reason. And if there were some things true about the president of Stand to Reason that were not true about Greg Kochel, then I wouldn't be that one. So strictly speaking, you have two characterizations of an individual of one thing. Okay, so that's the.
So you're saying there could be two Greg Kochels in the world? That's a little bit daunting.
There couldn't be, yes. And that's, of course, that's the difficulty. And so if we are saying that our souls are the same as any aspect of our physical body, we are saying they are one and the same thing. And all you got to do is find a difference between the two, and then that demonstrates they're not the same, and I gave some differences there. So I don't see how this observation that our body cells change, except for our neurons, has anything to do in any way undermines the argument for a durable self that is not physical.
And, you know, as you just expressed, there are a number and there are further arguments for consciousness apart from the claim that there's nothing about the body that actually survives over time. But he's asking, does this weaken the argument? So if there, because one argument for consciousness and identity is that it has to be something immaterial, because nothing physical is the same over time to tie identity over the course of a mm-hmm. lifetime. So, I mean, I completely agree with everything you said, and it doesn't do away with the argument. He's just asking,
does it undermine it some
there's
way?
We have made the claim that there's nothing physical that endures, so therefore the identity has to be something non-physical. Now, there might be something physical that actually does endure. You still have the further questions of, are they the same and all that kind
but
of
I,
stuff.
But I actually did address that when you think about it, because I was saying it's not just that even if, look at if you, the good ship Theseus, okay, mm-hmm. it's the classic philosophical illustration for this. If you have a ship and you replace half of the boards on the ship with other boards, is it still the same ship? Now, I think a lot of people might be tempted to say, well, it looks the same to me, so that is the same. And so what J.P. Moreland said is, just pretend that half of the ship is replaced with jello bowls, mm-hmm. boards instead of other wood boards. Oh, well, then it's clearly not the same ship anymore. So even if part of it's replaced and part of it's the same, it still makes the case that the physical thing is a different thing and it's not identical to what it was before. So the parallel here is, if that's the case in the body, some things are the same and some aren't, then the physical body isn't the same, but the self is the same. Therefore, the physical body and the self are not identical with each other. So I still think it works.
Okay. I was hoping you'd bring up the good ship Theseus. Hmm. And if I am my soul, I actually would still fit in my birth body.
Well, that's true. Your soul would.
Yep.
But strictly speaking, even to talk about it fitting is a physicalist way of putting it, and it's not a fit kind of thing because the souls aren't physical, and so they're not in our bodies like a pea is in a pod, say right. to spoke.
That's why if it's not physical, it fits in any.
That's right. It fits
my
in
soul
the sense
hasn't
that
bigger,
it's a
I've
category or that there's no fit that's necessary, right? It can be united. Right.
Next question comes from 82. Genesis 9. You got your Bible over there. Open it up, please.
I have Genesis memorized. I don't need to.
Genesis, then, okay, then 9, 4 to 5. Quote it for me.
Okay. Genesis 9, 4 to 5. Says,
he's
going to
quote
I'm,
it by reading
I'm going
it.
I'm through my memory Rolodex here.
Okay,
well, so Genesis 9 is the after the flood, okay? Mm-hmm. And wait, okay, let me just take a shot at it. This is...
well, you got
if
it
man,
open.
I'm not looking at it. If man sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God, God created man. Is that it? Let me look. No,
I
looked
so.
At you the whole time.
Yes, you
which
did.
Which was quite a distraction. So
sorry about that.
9, oh wait, okay, let me go to 9, 4, and 5. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life. Okay, so that is... Oh, that was verse 6. I was one verse off. Okay, not bad. All right, here's what 4
not
and
bad.
5
says. You got it wrong. It doesn't matter if you're close when you're quoting something. Okay, so the question is, let me say the question, then you
I'll
can read 4 and 5.
It's
Genesis 9, 4 to 5. It says, God will demand an accounting from every animal. Does that prove animals may go to heaven? Because there's a moral aspect to
them,
9,
4, and 5 doesn't say that.
What does
only
it say?
You shall not eat flesh with its life. Verse 3, every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. Only, verse 4, you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. 5, surely I will require your lifeblood. For from every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. And so that's the verse in question.
He seems to be drawing a leap from requiring as to an accounting. Okay. It's not the same thing.
To be honest with you, I don't know what verse 5 means.
Okay.
Surely I will require, this marginal rendering says literally, your blood of your lives, translated your lifeblood, from every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Now the next verse, though, is whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. And it could be that verse 5 is antecedent to verse 6. This is a never read the Bible or a Bible verse moment here. But again, I'm just working through this. I don't have a commentary with me, and I have not thought about that verse 5. But it might be leading into verse 6. So he's saying human beings are valuable over and above any other creature. And if man sheds man's blood, then man's blood will be shed. And if an animal sheds man's blood, then the animal's blood will be shed because of the value of man. And so verse 5 may be, and this is just speculation at this point, may be introductory to verse 6, which states more clearly what's at stake. I will require your lifeblood. Really? Regarding what? From every beast, I will require it. Why? And from every man. And from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Why? Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man. Actually, when I read it that way, it makes perfect sense to me. So verse 5 does not go with verse 4. It goes with verse 6.
So are animals going to go to heaven based on that?
No, I don't see. What it seems to be saying is that the lifeblood is required by God from every man or from every beast who sheds man's blood. That's what the way I'm reading it.
So 82 is interpreting that as an accounting from an animal if an animal harms a human being.
Well,
it's
not clear to me that what in the animal's case that this is a punishment for an immorality the animal commits. Okay, you have rogue animals that kill, that are domestic, that then kill the human beings, and those animals should be put down because they may kill again. Okay,
right, but that's right. It's like is coupled together with accounting from human beings too, and that's not why we would put down a human being.
Well, no, that isn't the reason why.
Seems to be coupled there together.
Well, the coupling, if my assessment if the pericope, or the, in a sense, the unit of thought is verse 5 and verse 6, then they go together, then it is making a statement simply about the value of human beings, not about the moral guilt of the ones who are being, who are killed.
Okay, good.
Who are doing the killing, rather.
Okay, good. Well, that was helpful. Never thought about that, those verses that way.
Me neither.
I know. Next question comes from Samsonel. Why must you show that one is wrong first before explaining why he is wrong?
Well, this is a question that pertains to a mistake a lot of people make, and it comes actually that's a paraphrase of C.S. Lewis there, and it's a quote that I offer frequently because it makes so much sense. Now, think of the question, though, just as offered. Why should I show that a person's wrong before I can tell you why he's wrong? Because you are giving an accounting of a state of affairs that which state of affairs have not been established yet. So why is that?
Right?
It's not exactly begging the question, but it's getting things in the wrong order. So I say, why is Brett Kunkel in the office today? And you look around and you say, Brett Kunkel's not in the office. Right, but why is he? And you say, that doesn't make any sense. To which I say, when I come to my senses, yeah, you're right, that doesn't make sense at all. In the same way, what sense does it make to say, here's the reason you're wrong, if I haven't first established that you're actually wrong?
And a lot of critics of Christianity have alternate explanations for how we came to our beliefs or why human beings would believe certain things. And they think the strength of that alternate explanation is enough to prove Christianity
to refute the idea itself,
right? When they haven't refuted it at all,
and this is in a in
you
a
have
piece.
Another saying an alternate explanation
is not a refutation,
right?
So it's just another story. You got to actually demonstrate that the alternate explanation is a better one than the one that you've considered. You can't just offer this up and that's it. You know, that's the end of the issue. You throw your gauntlet into the arena and say, I win. Well, wait a minute, you just got in the game. That's the second phrase there. Now, back to Lewis for just a moment. In his God in the Dock, a series of essays, he's got an essay called Bulverism, B-U-L-V-E-R-I-S-M, and it has to do with a guy named Bulver. You don't have to remember that. But he makes this particular point. And that is, if you say a person says, I've got a I think he talks about a financial situation. You know, says, "Well, you don't. Let me tell you why the person thinks he's a millionaire, because he's got grandiose ideas about himself." Well, wait a minute. Maybe he is a millionaire. First, look at his bank account. If he's not a millionaire, then it makes sense to ask why does he think he is when he's not, and then you can go to the psychological element. But first, you have to show that he's not. And the same thing goes, for example, with a very common mistake here, and I'm still within my four minutes here. I'm looking at my counter. It is the idea that the recycled redeemer or the copycat messiah, the rising and dying and rising Jesus is just a copycat of these other things. Well, that presumes that the account of Jesus' life is false, and it is and it is merely a copycat of something else. But notice that they presume that the account of Jesus' life is not historically reliable. They haven't demonstrated that. In fact, when you go to the primary source documentation, the historical support, it's really good. So if the thing really did happen, Jesus' life really happened, then it doesn't make any sense to say, here's how the myth started, if it's not a myth to begin with. First, you have to show that it's a myth, that it's false on its own merits, the accounts of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, before it's meaningful to ask, well, where did this mythology then come from? And so in this case, though, the critics, the tail is wagging the dog. They got it in reverse, and they would be good to take their counsel from C.S. Lewis in his fine little piece called Bulverism. I talk about this, by the way, in more detail in The Story of Reality.
Oh, a book you wrote?
Did write that, didn't
There's I? Also a Solid Ground that you wrote about this, too.
Yeah.
That you can get online.
Yeah, it's called Recycled Redeemer. I gave a talk on this as well. Yep. And then there's this wonderful illustration about the Titanic that is perfect for this
You point. Are over your 4 minutes now.
Titanic.
Yep. Recycled Redeemer. Check it out on the website. Read about that Titanic thing. Jim Wallace, J. Warner Wallace, also has a great analysis of this, too, on his website, Cold Case Christianity, too.
The analysis of the Recycled Redeemer.
Well, you make the point in the Recycled Redeemer, and I feel like we just talked about this not too many weeks ago on this podcast about what would seem like, you know, an impossibility that there was actually a book written about a ship named the
Titan.
Titan
in Futility, 1898.
That sank.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost identical to the Titanic.
So many details, that's right.
But it was a fiction book, Jim has another parallel account where somebody, a comparison with John Kennedy.
Yeah.
And all these similarities, but it's not the president of the United States.
Right.
To come up with an alternate explanation, you're starting too far downstream.
Right.
You have to go back upstream and prove that something's wrong first.
You've got to demonstrate an error, and then it makes sense to ask, well, then how did such an error come about?
Right.
But you can't just say, here's how the error came about without showing that it's an error to begin
with.
Yeah.
Too often people get very enamored of their alternate explanation.
Sure, yeah.
and a lot of times Christians feel the burden of proof to undermine and to reply mm-hmm. to that alternate explanation instead of encouraging the critic to go back and do
sure.
their homework
first. Can I buy 30 seconds here?
Yes.
More? Okay, good. Put it on my bill. When I saw Michael Shermer debate Doug Guyvett the very first time at Rocky Peak here in the Valley in Los Angeles area, he made this particular point, and it immediately occurred. Michael Shermer
okay.
made this argument, which he continues to do now,
yeah.
many almost over a decade later, same point, which has been thoroughly refuted. Nevertheless, he keeps doing it. And it seemed to me so obvious at the moment that if I were to go up to Michael Shermer and I said, "You're Michael Shermer? Really? No, you couldn't be. Yes, I am. No, you can't be. Why can't I be Michael Shermer?" Because I've had six people in the last 6 months that have told me they were Michael Shermer and they weren't. Therefore, you can't be Michael Shermer either. Mm-hmm. Now, the flaw there is quite obvious in that illustration, but that's exactly the way that Shermer himself was arguing regarding the person of Jesus of Nazareth.
And he's a perfect example of how very, very intelligent people can make
foolish mistakes,
very fundamental mistakes
when it comes to spiritual thinking. Thanks,
rather. That's it for this episode, folks. A little bit of a long one. I'm Melinda the Enforcer with Greg Kolkel for Stand to Reason.